Morning and welcome back to the second hour, Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Freinet controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we will be talking a little bit about food and about urban community planning. Now, it might seem at first blush that those two things don't really have a lot to do with each other, at least when we think about people who do urban planning. We understand that those folks spend a lot of their time thinking about things like transportation and housing and economic development, and perhaps not very much time thinking about food and where it comes from and how it gets to people where they are and how they get to it. But we will be talking this morning with a guest who does indeed work in the area of planning and has for a long time, who is interested, among other things, in community food system planning. His name is Jerome Kaufman. He is here visiting the campus to take part in a conference that now has been going on here for a number of years, the Annual Planning Institute, which is hosted by the U of I's Department of Urban and Regional Planning. Community Design for Healthy Lifestyles is the theme this time around. It's now in its sixth year, and we will be talking with a couple of people here this morning with our guest, Professor Kaufman, and then another, Richard Killingsworth. He'll be here to talk with us about a little bit different subject on the program tomorrow in our 10 o'clock hour. But this morning we'll be concentrating on this idea of food and food systems. And we'd be very happy to have whatever questions, comments people might have. Our guest, Jerome Kaufman, is Emeritus Professor of Urban and Regional Planning at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Has been working in the planning field for a long time. Among other things, has been visiting professor at the University of Amsterdam. He's also lectured on planning subjects other places around the world, in Belgium, Germany, Italy, England, Norway, France, Israel, over the past 10 years or so. He served as president of the Association of Collegiate Schools of Planning, and in 2000 became the first planner from Wisconsin to be elected to the American Institute of Planners College of Fellows. He's here with us in the studio. Questions, comments certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Okay. Thank you for inviting me.
How did you, I think you point out, I had a chance to take a look at a paper that you wrote explaining your thinking on this subject, and started out talking about the fact that it maybe wouldn't have been all that long ago that in your maybe professional and also personal life, you would have said, well, this is something that it's not something that I've spent a lot of time thinking about. And as you point out, for people who work in the planning field, mostly, it hasn't been something that planners have really thought very much about. They've thought about a lot of other stuff, but not really about this. So how did you first start to get, in a professional sense, interested in this subject?
Yeah. Well, this about 8 years or so ago, a group of people from my university, a large group of them, plus the number of community folk, got together to work on a proposal to the Kellogg Foundation to see what agricultural colleges, in land-grant colleges, we are a land-grant college, could do in the future, since their constituencies, they felt, were changing. Farmers were diminishing in number, and were there other links that could be established between agriculture colleges and communities? I participated in that effort. I knew something about cities and metropolitan areas. I knew beans about food, though. But I went off to the University of Amsterdam for a year on sabbatical then. And when I came back, the proposal was funded. That was fine. But then I was asked whether I'd head up one of the parts of this new proposal, which was a particular project called the Madison Area Food System Project. My first inclination was to say no, because I didn't know that much about the food system. I'm like many Americans. I go into a supermarket. The shelves are amply stocked. My needs are fulfilled. It's open any time of day. It's accessible to me, and the food is modestly priced. What's the problem? What do I need to do much in this area for? But then I started thinking as a planner that there's a hole in our field. We're a field that says we should be comprehensive. We should take into account all of the systems of a community that make it up and how they relate to each other. And when I looked at the literature in our field, the planning discipline, I saw a hole. There was very little that has ever been written about the food system. And when you think about food, what's more essential than air, water, and food, and shelter, too? Planners are involved in air, water, and shelter, but they weren't involved in food. So as a person who spent my professional career kind of roaming around and getting into interesting topics, I said, well, this may be something that would be worthwhile to explore. There's a lot of turf to till, so to speak. Yeah. And so I accepted the invitation, and from then on, it became a transformative experience for me. Yeah. My wife and I belong to a community-supported agriculture farm. We shop in a local food co-op. We buy organic food. I started a compost. I'm even learning about how to make compost out of vermiculture and raising tilapia fish in a closed-loop system and so on. And you have, putting this in context, I grew up in New York City in a dense urban environment, a lower working class neighborhood. I don't think I saw a farm till I was 16 years old.
Yeah. So, and you think none of that would have happened? These, you know, your current interest, what you're doing now, if you hadn't got into thinking about this in a professional kind of way, none of that would have happened. You just wouldn't have.
I think so. Yeah. Yes, that's true.
Yeah. One of the things that you point out that I think is worth talking about is that. In spite of the fact that maybe planners hadn't, the idea of the food system hadn't really thought about that very much, you have to, once you start thinking about it, the ways in which the food system, and here we're talking about wholesale, retail, where food is grown, where it comes from, where people go to consume it, if you also count restaurants in addition to places where people go and buy food, grocery stores, and then perhaps even when you take it one step further and talk about the fact, well, you know, there's a lot of waste that's generated in this process one way or another. But that touches the economics of communities in many, many ways when you think about how much income is generated, how many people are employed, that is a big chunk of life in any community, but certainly in an urban community it is. And yet maybe that hasn't always been acknowledged.
Yeah. Well, there's a divide that exists among many of us. The urban dwellers don't really have much appreciation for rural areas and rural people and farmers. And I can't say that in the other respect for the rural versus the urban, but that divide really is an artificial one and ought to be closed. In many ways, when we think of food, we basically think of the beginning of the food chain that you were outlining, the production of food, mm-hmm. and where most of that grows, of course, is in rural areas. But when we think of the whole food sector, right down the chain in terms of the distribution of the food that's grown, the processing of the food that's grown, the wholesaling, the retailing, and down to the tail end of what do we do with the waste that we create in the food system, where do we dispose of it, and so on, we begin to see the complexity of it. And it has many impacts on communities that most of us live in. For example, my students in a project when I first got into this did a study in the Dane County area, which is where Madison is positioned, and found out that 53% of the retail sector jobs in Madison were food sector jobs. And that was a surprising statistic to come across. And when we started thinking about it, well, there were reasons for that. We see from studies that the amount of money that the average household in America spends on food, half of that or 40% of that money is spent on eating outside of the home. Well, that has triggered the growth of restaurants, many different restaurants, as well as fast food places and so on. And it's pretty obvious if anybody lives in a community like that. And that's happened really within the last 15, 20 years. In 1900, we were hardly ever eating outside of the home. And over the century, those figures have continually dropped about eating inside the home. So we're creating new opportunities for people to eat out. And these tend to be labor-intensive places, and they don't pay that much. But they become an important source of the economy or the economic means that people need to survive in cities. A lot of lower-income people work in those facilities. Toronto, which is one of the leading cities in the North America, contends that close to 15% of their total jobs are food sector jobs. And it's not just in the production end. So it has definitely a strong economic impact in terms of the sales of products as well as the job employment and so on. But it also has other kinds of impacts on communities. A lot of farms are still using a heavy amount of chemical fertilizers and pesticides, and there's runoff problems that affect our water supply, our lakes and our rivers, which are used by community residents. So there's a link there. Estimates have been made of the amount of transportation, auto use, to get to purchase food choices or restaurants and so on. And some of the estimates range in the vicinity of 20% of all of the car trips in communities are related to the food sector. There are other kinds of spin-offs related to food waste. We found in our study in Madison that close to a third of the waste that ends up in our landfill is food waste. But what's interesting, half of that waste is food packaging. That is, it's the stuff we see in the average supermarket, which has anywhere from 40 to 60,000 products on its shelves. What do we do with the wrappers and so on, particularly the stuff that is not biodegradable and so on? They end up in landfills, and their problems, I'm trying to get a public policy, is to try to reduce the amount of landfills that we have because of some of the leaching problems that are in landfills. So in many different ways, the food system is much more complex and affects our lives, but we're not aware of it. There's a special impact on poorer people, though. And that's when you see, one, it's a source of employment, food sector jobs, but it also is a contributor to other kinds of problems. If you look, for example, at the location of supermarkets in many American communities, you will find a dearth of supermarkets left in lower income areas, ostensibly because their incomes are lower and supermarkets have pulled out. Well, what's so bad about that? Well, supermarkets sell fresh produce, healthier food, so what's left is convenience stores, higher priced, usually with a plentiful supply of junk food and so on. As well as fast food restaurants. Studies have shown that the greater preponderance of fast food restaurants are located more accessible to low-income areas than they are to wealthier areas. And we know about some of the problems with eating fast foods. They tend to have higher fat and sugar content and so on. So it creates a problem of which we're becoming much more aware of now, which is the obesity and overweight problem that Americans have. The figures for obesity in the United States among the American population is from 1980 to 2000. It went up from something like 12% to about 23% of the population is obese. If you add that to overweight population, we're a little above 60% of our population is either overweight or obese. And a particular problem is children. And the incidence of overweight and obesity is even greater in poorer ethnic and racial communities in some of our communities. So my contention is that food system has some very significant impacts on communities and the residents who live in communities, and we need to understand that more clearly.
Yeah. We have a caller here I want to get to, and I should also introduce again our guest. We're talking this morning with Jerome Kaufman. He's Emeritus Professor of Urban and Regional Planning at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's here, one of the people who have come here to Champaign-Urbana. We'll be here for a couple of days taking part in the Planning Institute for 2005. It's an event that's been going on here annually for a few years, sponsored by the Department of Urban and Regional Planning, Community Design for Healthy Lifestyles. That's the theme going on today and tomorrow on the U of I campus. Questions are certainly welcome. Questions, comments, people who are listening, if you'd like to call in, be involved in the conversation, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Belgium over by Danville on line four. Hello.
Good morning, sir. I'm not sure that from the gist of the conversation you've had so far that maybe I'm not going to talk about something that you want to discuss, but I'm going to give it a shot. As a child and a young person, I was always required to go help my grandfather, who supported himself completely on 4 acres of ground. He had chickens and a hog and a cow they got milk from and a nice-sized garden, and he lived pretty much right there. Obviously, he got his coffee and his sugar from elsewhere, but you know what I'm saying. He took care of most of his own needs personally and on his own property. As I grew up and got older, I married a young lady whose father had 8 acres. And he and I would raise cattle, and we'd sell the cattle and provide our own beef, and we had a nice garden, did it. And after a few years, we finally stopped doing that. But now, as time has come along, we live at the edge of a, though this is not a very fast-growing community, but I notice it in all other communities, we live next to a community that is now trying to overtake these areas and not allow any kind of agriculture in that sort of vein. No livestock, per se. They're glad we let you have your gardens, but they don't really want the livestock. And thereby really changing what used to be a traditional way of people feeding themselves right on the ground that they were at. And it seems though now we're pushing ourselves not to allow that at all. And I was wondering, since you are in urban planning, there's probably no way around that problem, but if you see what I'm saying, it's a real loss.
Mm-hmm. Well, I understand what you're saying. I think you're talking about a issue that has been a prominent issue among planners as well as a lot of other public policy officials, is the conflict that exists between the need to grow communities out further, taking land, and that land is often agricultural land. And so we have different kinds of programs, agricultural land preservation programs and so on, to try to retain some of the farm land. But part of it, I think, is something that I mentioned very briefly at the beginning. There is not much of an appreciation, I think, among a lot of dwellers of urban places of the life and the lifestyles of rural people. We have a divide that needs to be kind of eliminated in the future. It's very interesting because a lot of urban dwellers would like to see farmland in their regions for reasons of containing sprawl, more compact development. But also, the research shows that they would like those open spaces, those vistas, the places that they can look and get out of the city and so on. But they don't really have an appreciation much for the act of producing food on land. That's not their central concern. There is a movement that is developed in this country, which is growing in strength, to help family farmers survive economically And that's one of the components of it. And that means to create more markets for people who live in urban regions or metropolitan regions so that farmers would have more markets and actually retain more of the dollars from their farming enterprises. If you look at the statistics, you'll also see that the percentage of money that the farmer gets out of a dollar that's spent on the food system and so on continues to shrink now. I think it's below 20% of that dollar, whereas it used to be 40% or so on. So it's difficult to make ends meet, particularly if you're not a large corporate farmer. The subsidy systems that we have at the federal level are not necessarily favoring smaller farmers as well. It's the bigger giant corporate farmers and so on. So I think the dilemma that you've posed is something that is also traceable to the misunderstanding of rural life. I remember one scene of a play that was produced by a group of talented, creative people who came from rural backgrounds about life on a farm. And it was shown all over the city of Madison. And it was a wonderful insight to a lot of urban dwellers who don't have an appreciation for that. And you come away from something like that and you say, well, wait a minute, we got to learn more about what's going on in that area so that we can understand the subtleties of the kinds of problems that you face as a farmer.
Yeah, I noticed that you say city folks do like to move out in the country, but sometimes they don't like the associated aspects of farming. Mm-hmm. They don't like the smell in particular. It is a very big problem. As a matter of fact, I think possibly that might have been part of the reason why the South farms in Champaign moved farther south, because people didn't want the odor, and didn't want the bother of the thing. So I may be broadening that more than I really need to there, but you understand what I'm saying there, I'm sure.
Certainly. Yes.
Well, thank you very much, sir.
All right, you're thanks. Welcome. Let's go to Danville for another caller. This is line number one. Hello. Is there a caller there, line one? Well, perhaps not. I don't know. Maybe we can check it. Yes, I am told there is a caller. Is there a caller there? Line one? Okay. Well, maybe we had a problem with that call, and maybe he can call us back. In fact, anybody can call. You want to be involved in a conversation, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Perhaps I should introduce again the guest. That would be a good thing to do. Jerome Kaufman, he is Emeritus Professor of Urban and Regional Planning at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, has been an active planner for a long time, something like five decades. He was planner in Philadelphia. I did not mention he was professor here at University of Illinois in Urbana. He's been researcher for the American Society of Planning Officials, and then for a long time, since the early 70s, he's been at Madison. He's here visiting to take part in a conference, the Annual Planning Institute, looking at community design for healthy lifestyles, is sponsored by the Department of Urban and Regional Planning, taking place today and tomorrow. And tomorrow, in fact, on the program, we'll have another guest who is also here for the conference, Richard Killingsworth. He's from University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and we'll be talking about community design for healthy lifestyles. I want to come back to something that you talked about. I think it's really interesting and worth thinking about, and that is the fact that not everybody has the same array of choices for places to go and get their food, and that has consequences. And I think it's something that we maybe don't think very much in a community like this, even though it's not such a large community. We have a wide range of large food retailers, and then we have a lot of smaller specialty retailers, and we have, during the summer at least, we have farmers markets, and there are people around here in our region that produce all kinds of things, and you can go directly, if you want, to somebody who produces the food, and you can buy eggs and cheese and meat and other kinds of produce. And then if you decide you want to go out to eat, well, there's a wide range of choices too. Everybody doesn't have that kind of range of choice. And it is in urban settings, particularly in more disadvantaged ones, their choices are much more limited. And there are real consequences for that. And you touched on one of them, which I think for a lot of people is going to be counterintuitive. They're going to say, well, wait a minute, there's some relationship between poverty and obesity. Say, no, that doesn't make any sense to me. Poor people are supposed to be thin. They're not supposed to have. But you know what your choices, the quality of the food that you have access to. Well, that's a real issue, and all of those things operate in urban settings, mm-hmm. and they're, you know, if that's not the kind of place you live, maybe you don't really think about that very mm-hmm. much. You know, you think champagne, everything's like champagne, but well, it's
yeah.
not.
Well, I started out that way. I think, you know, what's the problem is basically the way to look at it. Let me respond in two ways. One, more directed to answer your question, but also to say that even us middle class people should be thinking in a different way about this, not just about the problems of the poor, although I think we should be aware of that. As far as the poor is concerned, we ultimately probably end up paying for some of the problems that you've pointed to. If we're getting to be more obese, the studies show that or overweight, the studies show that these lead to health problems. Cancer, certain kinds of cancers are associated with diet-related what we eat. Incidences of type 2 diabetes, heart disease, and so on. People have to have medical care and so on. And if they're indigent or they don't have, maybe, you know, we're paying for Medicaid and so on. So those, there's connections to us as people who have more accessibility to food. Poor people don't have access to cars as much, so they have to travel further. We have a tremendously large emergency food system in the United States that dates back only to 1980. We get a lot of surplus foods that are donated to places like Second Harvests and Share and so on, food pantries and hot meal sites and so on. And when you think of a poor person who is short on income and so on, and thinks at the end of the month that they're going to need to stretch that dollar, what are they going to pay? They'll pay their rent because they need a roof over their house and cut back on their food expenses and so on. And so they'll tend to use the emergency food system, and the studies show that more people, not just poor people, are beginning to use the emergency food shelters as a more regular way of keeping their heads above water. So there are impacts on the poor of this system that affect them, but also spill over to the rest of us in society because we end up paying for some of those costs. But there's a lot of hidden costs that affect us as middle income and upper income people in the food system. If we go into a supermarket, the average supermarket, and we get our two bags of food and we end up at the cash register and pay for our food, well, it doesn't sound like a lot of money. Actually, the figures show that the average household in America, out of the dollar they spend on all community expenditure, consumer expenditures, is spending only 13 cents of that dollar on food today. In 1900, we were spending 40 cents on the dollar and so on. So it continues to go down. Even poor people spend maybe 17% and so on. So food sounds pretty cheap. On the other hand, we're still paying money for it because other costs have gone up. But we go out of the supermarket, and we've satisfied our needs in terms of our food purchases. But we rarely think of the hidden costs that are involved in getting that food and producing that food. One is, for example, the fossil fuel that is used to transport food long distances. They say that the average food product travels 1,500 to 2,500 miles in the United States from farm to table and so on. That uses a lot of fuel, a lot of oil or oil equivalent kind of products and so on. And the estimates are astronomical in terms of what the food system produces. Here's a figure from if I can find it here, England. An average household in England uses something like 4 tons a year for car expenses that generate greenhouse gas like carbon dioxide. The average English household uses 4 tons, if I did say that. The average English household uses 8 tons of food, greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide, for all of the steps in the food process, for the food that it eats and so on. So we're actually using more energy in our food purchases than we are in our automobile expenditures. And I suspect if you did the study in the United States, it would probably be higher for auto use. But the point is, we're using a lot of fossil fuel for this. That's a hidden cost. The runoff problems from farms and so on, and the effects on water pollution and so on, and eutrophication and algae growing in lakes and rivers and so on, that's a cost, too, of the food system and the way it operates. The food waste that ends up in landfills is another cost. And obviously with the obesity problem, when some people are eating the wrong kinds of food, they end up with public health costs and so on. The food industry in the United States, which is about a it's $1.25 trillion sector. It's a giant sector. It represents something like 13% of the gross domestic product in the United States. That food industry produces a lot of food that we eat. If you go into the average restaurant now, you'll see big portions and so on. We overproduce food in this country now, and that has spinoffs and external costs to our life. So we need to appreciate more the hidden costs of the food system so that when we walk out of the food store, we should be saying, well, what are we doing are we affecting also the water pollution problem we have in terms of environmental impacts? What are we doing in terms of people who have too much food or the wrong kinds of food to eat because of what we have here? Are we producing greater health costs and so on? And fossil fuel energy, how much are we using to produce that, to get that food to the supermarkets and so on. And that's why there's an interest now in building up the strength and capacity of community food systems so that we become more self-sufficient in terms of our local and regional food production and so on.
Yeah. I think we got that the Danville caller back again. We'll try that on line number one. I think someone calling on a cell phone. Hello. Yes.
Hello, yes.
Yes.
Yes, I don't know where to start. This is a great discussion and often ignored. But I wonder if you could speak as a planner to desirability of mixed land systems within an urban and suburban area, not only for food system production, but for the whole process of education on how the food gets there. For example, people actually buying local food or using local food in a slow food restaurant or whatever. Generally have a much better understanding of what it takes to raise that food and get it. And the costs of having open land are much less in terms of infrastructure than having a big suburban subdivision with all the land outside it. I wonder if you could speak to planning issues around that.
Sure, I'll try. I think the educational question is very important. I know there was a project in my community, Madison, a few years ago, where youngsters in a couple of the schools were actually given a training session on the food system and the necessity to kind of understand it better and the hidden costs and externalities and so on. And one of the interesting things that happened is they came home and they became teachers of their parents who didn't really have an appreciation for some of the issues that they were being exposed to. So when we think of how to develop this consciousness of perhaps doing things in a different way, it does start with education, and it could start in the schools, and it could start with a number of kind of organizations that now currently exist in a number of communities, like Slow Food, like the Community Food Security Coalition, which is a national organization of people who are pushing for these alternative community food systems. But at some point, we have to deal with some of the realities of what exists on the ground. The food industry, this mega industry in the United States, spends $11 billion on direct media advertising a year to advertise its products. 70% of that $11 billion is spent on confectionery goods, candy, desserts, things that don't have that much nutritious value. We spend about 2.2% on promoting or advertising vegetables and fruits and beans and grains and things like that. McDonald's and Burger King, when you put their advertising budgets together, they spend over $1 billion a year on advertising their products. The five-a-day program that the American Cancer Society, as well as the federal government, have collaborated on for many years now, eating five vegetables and fruits a day, they spend less than $300 million on advertising that program. So there are tremendous constraints in terms of getting these messages across to the average person in the community. But we're also seeing around the country in some places alternatives springing up that we didn't see 10 years ago. For example, if you take some of the older cities in the United States and think of cities like Detroit or parts of Chicago parts of what we would call the Rust Belt in the Midwest, where vacant land is much more plentiful than it ever was because of the exodus of population out to the suburbs and so on. We have a lot of vacant land. Detroit has 70,000 vacant lots.
I just read about a project similar to that in, I think it was Manchester, Vermont, or Manchester, New Hampshire, where they did take a brownfield and convert it into a community garden.
That's right. And we see those kinds of projects popping up around the country now, where community-based organizations are building or developing or growing food in community gardens, or even in entrepreneurial ventures where they are growing food to sell to markets. It may be farmers markets or upscale restaurants in the community that will like that fresh produce and it's accessible and so on. Or even value-added products, making salsa sauce or vinegar or raising honey through bees and so on.
Or even wineries, which are often on the edge of urban areas.
That's right. So it's a rather heretical idea to grow food in the city, but it's being done today in the United States. By the way, it's being done more in the United States in these kinds of communities than in Europe. And the reason it isn't is because there's no vacant land in cities.
Are you aware of one of the University of Illinois programs Robin Orr does with WIC in Chicago, where they have urban gardens as part of the WIC program?
I think I have heard about it, but I'm not really familiar with it. But I think I heard it mentioned.
That was kind of the same thing to drive awareness. Nutritional value, you can raise food yourself, as well as get those kinds of farmer-generated or even local garden-generated things onto the list of foods that could be used.
One of the spinoffs of this interest I have in food issues is that I am currently the chair of a nonprofit organization, urban agriculture organization in Milwaukee called Growing Power.
Okay.
And it's a It's a fascinating project because it was started by an African-American former professional basketball player by the name of Will Allen. He's 6 feet, 7 inches tall, grew up on a farm in Maryland, moved back after he finished his professional basketball career playing in a European basketball league, and started a farm in the southern part of the Milwaukee metropolitan area. But his true passion was to work with inner city kids and teaching them about how to grow food and how to build community through that process. He bought the last remaining greenhouses in the city of Milwaukee and converted them into laboratories for all kinds of growing projects. I mentioned that I'm learning how to grow compost through vermiculture. He's got all kinds of vermiculture bills. He's got he's raising something like 4,000 tilapia in a kind of a fish tank that you can buy from a Menards or a Walmart's cheap, but it's a closed loop system and so on. Last year, and by the way, they are now in Chicago as well, and they have urban gardens that they've developed. But last year, in the middle of the loop, right across from the Picasso statue in Daly Square, there's one block that never was developed. It eventually will be developed. And his organization got permission to bring in topsoil and in raised beds. They grew vegetables in the middle of the loop against these high-rise buildings. And it was a remarkable kind of image to capture, because here you had these youngsters tending every day, and these were kids from the south side, north side, and west side of Chicago, growing the food, and all sorts of people were walking by, and first, you know, with an amazed look on their life, and then it became part of the natural landscape. So
that's a great project, and I think education of this generation coming up is the key to it. Maybe too late for my baby boomer generation to turn around, but I think the younger ones have that chance. I'll get off the phone, and this has been a great conversation. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. And we'll go next to someone listening in Atlanta, Illinois, on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hi. Thank you, gentlemen. This is a great conversation about food and one of my big interests. I kind of brought this up to David. This whole idea happened, or I started learning about this on his show several years ago. There was a scientist that had went to Cuba, and after the Russians had pulled out, the Cubans were in terrible shape as far as food and the fact that they relied so much on importing stuff, but they pulled themselves up by their bootstraps, and with organic, one reason they didn't have the fertilizers and stuff to do it on their own, but through organic means they were able to really feed everybody. And this scientist said, with no, you know, their government aside, that he sure didn't believe in that form of government, but the people themselves had really been the models for organic farming you know, around the world, and a good model for us maybe to look to. This was his opinion. And then I noticed a couple of years ago on National Geographic, they had the state of the world map. And this gets right to what the subject is here. The only positive thing on that whole map as far as the environment was concerned, in Havana, Cuba, there was 22,000 gardens that were providing I don't know how many hundreds of tons of food to those people, which is exactly what you're saying that we could do in this country. So I just wanted your reflections on maybe we could look to our neighbors for some advice instead of the other way around, and I'll listen here, and if you want to ask me something, I'll be here.
Yeah, well, I am familiar with the Cuba experiment, and you've kind of outlined how it all happened, and it still is going on. It's a little more difficult to get into Cuba now, but there are groups that have gone down there in recent times, and they still marvel at what the Cubans are doing. Basically, it's a pesticide-free environment and so on. Not because the Cubans wanted to do it that way, but they went had to go cold turkey when their supply of pesticides from the Eastern Bloc countries, particularly Russia, you know, was cut off because of the collapse of the Soviet Union. But they also have different neighborhoods of Havana, little kind of buildings where you can get the equipment, seed, fertilizer. All of the equipment you need to grow that food. So it makes it even more accessible and so on. It's not just in Havana, I think in Camagüey and some of the other communities as well. Some people in this movement have looked to Cuba as one of the leaders, but it does run into the politics of Cuba and so on. But I don't know if anybody has really denied the existence of the success of what the Cubans have done as far as urban agriculture is concerned, and it is considered to be one of the leading models in the world.
Well, thanks for your conversation today.
All right. Thank you for the
call.
Thank
you.
We have about five minutes left in the program. I want to come back around to planning, because that's kind of where we started. And we talked about the fact, you talked about the fact, first of all, just how significant the food system is in a number of ways, how it contributes to the economy, how many issues are related to it, and the fact that often urban planners, who think about a lot of different things, but maybe hadn't thought about this all that much. And we've talked about some of the things that have been going on, particularly here. We've been talking a little bit about the idea of urban agriculture and how that kind of experiments that have been going on there in a kind of a grassroots sort of way with groups, local people and groups here and there organizing and working on that way. What can planners do to encourage, facilitate this kind of thing, or perhaps incorporate in their planning the food system and perhaps also building into communities some opportunities for some local production?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's beginning to happen in a small sort of way. Just as a preface to your question, let me just say that a colleague of mine a few years ago did a study of planners, senior planners in about 22 different planning agencies around the country. And we wanted to find out the extent of their involvement in food system issues. And we found a little involvement, but not much, but no kind of great success stories. And then we asked for the reasons why. And they gave us a bunch of reasons. Some of them I've touched on already. Is what's the problem in the food system? It seems to be working okay. Planning agencies aren't funded to do food system planning. And in this age of tighter budgets and so on, they say, well, the incentive isn't there. Some of them said, well, the food system is driven primarily by the private market and so on. And we tend to look at either areas where the market isn't working that well or the public kind of commodities like open space and water and so on. But what was interesting was some of the comments that they made. And I just want to, as a contrast, tell you about one of them that really stuck out in our mind. He said, the most telling comment, and this is a comment from our article, this is a most telling comment about the inconceivability of food system planning to some planners was, and this is a direct quote, if someone in the planning agency suggested we do planning for the local food system, he'd be looked at as if he came from Mars. Now, that's partly what we're up against in our own profession. But there are indications that that view is changing now and that a number of planners coming at it from different ways are beginning to see the food system as an important part of creating healthy communities and more livable and sustainable living environments. And one of the things in particular that planning agencies can do is to become more receptive to the possibilities of putting into their plans or suggesting policies that would be more supportive or friendly towards community food systems. And there are policies that are beginning to be incorporated, and I can just tick off a couple of them. For example, supporting public campaigns that promote regionally produced foods, in effect, buy local products. That has been suggesting. Making community gardens a permitted use in all zoning districts. They're not even recognized in most zoning ordinances. But why make it more difficult? Allow them to be developed, it gives him more stability and legitimacy in the minds of a lot of public officials. Make farmers markets and fresh food markets standard features across the city. Place a high priority on creating permanent sites for farmers markets in urban agriculture, incorporating necessary utilities, parking, and loading areas into the design. Environmental resources. Foster a strong regional system of food production, distribution, access, and reuse that protects our natural resources and contributes significantly to the environmental well-being of the region. Sustainable development, health, neighborhood development, food waste disposal. Set a goal of zero nutrient loss from food waste for city resource management systems. In effect, encourage composting instead of disposal of that kind of stuff. So there are a number of ways and examples now that are emerging of planning agencies starting to become more accommodating and supportive of community food systems, as well as the studies that are done. Planners have particular strengths and capacities, and they could participate and add quality to some of the community food assessments that are being done throughout the country now.
Well, we're going to have to stop there because we've come to the end of the time. I want to say thanks to our guest for this hour, Jerome Kaufman. He's Emeritus Professor of Urban and Regional Planning at University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's here, one of the people who have gathered here on the campus for the U of I Planning Institute for 2005. It's hosted by the Department of Urban and Regional Planning, the theme overall, community design for healthy lifestyles. A lot of different people coming and having conversations and giving talks, and he's one of them. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
I do also want to mention, too, that another of the guests who will be here for this as part of this conference, Richard Killingsworth, will be here. He is director of Active Living by Design at the School of Public Health at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's one of the speakers, and we'll be talking some more about this idea of community design for healthy lifestyles tomorrow in the 10 o'clock hour of this program. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week, and I always welcome your questions and comments. The show, by the way, is made possible by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. The broadcast is also made possible by 10,000 Villages. 10,000 Villages' 13th annual showcase of Fair Trade Oriental Rugs will be held March 9th through the 12th at their store, 105 North Walnut in downtown Champaign. On Tuesday, March 10th at 7 p.m., an informational seminar about Oriental Rugs will be held at the store. For more information, you may call them at 352-8200. And that's it for us. We want you to stay tuned, though. Coming up next, the Afternoon Magazine, the host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we're going to talk about regret. Our guest will be Neil Rose. He's an associate professor of psychology at the University of Illinois. He's the author of a book about regret for lay readers that looks at the science of regret and offers practical advice for using regret to move forward. The book's title, If Only, How to Turn Regret into Opportunity. That follows the 1 o'clock news this afternoon. Let's turn our attention now to the Chicago Board of Trade, where March wheat is trading at 329, down 3. July, 344, down 3 and a quarter. March corn, 209, down 1 and a quarter. May, 217 and 3 quarters, down 1 and a quarter. July, 224 and 3 quarters, down 1 and a half. And December corn, 239 and a quarter, down 3 quarters. March beans, 613 and a half, down 5 and a quarter. May, 622 and a half, down 4 and 3 quarters.